The last investigator I met with was Dr. Claudine Isaacs, who brought several cases from her practice to discuss, beginning with a young woman with locally advanced disease.
So this is, I think, an example of a patient that we're seeing frequently these days. This is a 47-year-old woman who presents to the medical oncologist. She just had a core biopsy done because she presented to her primary care doctor with a palpable mass, and she went on to get imaging and a core biopsy. And she was found to have a poorly differentiated triple-negative breast cancer. The tumor was 3.4 centimeters. In largest diameter on imaging, and she also had a clinically involved axillary node. And so, you know, one of the first questions on that is, you know, how do we approach this? What do we need to do in terms of other types of biopsies, other types of evaluations? And, you know, there's a bit of a debate, and I think there's a non-uniformity on the approach to the axilla in somebody where you're considering neoadjuvant chemotherapy. Some people believe that they'd prefer to do a sentinel node up front and confirm whether there's an involved axillary node, and some others think that we should just do an FNA and leave the node in place. At our institution, we tend to just do FNAs to confirm if the node is involved or not to help guide treatment recommendations.
What about imaging in this situation and imaging when clinically the axilla is negative?
So the imaging, most women these days, they're obviously getting a bilateral mammogram. Many women in this country are also getting bilateral breast MRI with gadolinium. Usually, if there is question of nodal involvement, women will get an ultrasound of that area to have a look at it. And often then you ask the radiologist or the surgeon will do an FNA of that node.
And how in general would you approach the therapy of a patient like this? And how would you integrate the evaluation of the axilla in your own practice?
So in terms of the treatment, if you have a woman with a larger tumor, it's a medium-sized T2, so about 3.5 centimeters, I think that a woman, particularly one with triple negative or HER2 positive breast cancer, you know, should see a medical oncologist in conjunction with the surgeon and have a discussion about neoadjuvant chemotherapy. My own bias for any woman who has a tumor over 2.5 centimeters, particularly one with a clinically involved node, is to more strongly consider neoadjuvant chemotherapy. But I do think for a woman like this, if she is a surgical candidate and she wishes to pursue surgery first, if she has a non-HER2 positive breast cancer, I think it's reasonable to go ahead with surgery first and then do systemic therapy down the line.
In patients who are going to get neoadjuvant therapy, can you comment on the issue of putting a clip in with the biopsy? And is that kind of uniformly done?
That's a critically important point, and it's one that's really important to remember. Those patients should absolutely have a clip put in. They should have a clip put in the breast mass, and they should also have a clip put in if a node is found to be positive. They should have a clip put in that node so the surgeon down the line could make sure that they address that area. The other thing that's important, and occasionally I see patients like this, is they have some other questionable area that's picked up on imaging. So before you start neoadjuvant chemotherapy or neoadjuvant systemic therapy, you want to make sure to address all of the questionable areas so you know if there's a second malignancy there. You want to do that for, I think, two main reasons. The first is to make sure if it is a cancer that it has the same characteristics as the first one. And while that would be the likeliest thing, we do see that synchronous primaries can have different characteristics and you'd want to make sure to treat them both. I had a patient who had, you know, one small hormone receptor positive one and the other one was ER negative and HER2 positive. And it's really important that when you're done with everything that you make sure you've treated both tumors appropriately with the appropriate targeted therapy if it's indicated, so be it endocrine therapy or HER2 targeted therapy, for instance. And then the second reason to make sure to address any questionable other areas, if a second malignancy is found, that would obviously have implications in terms of the surgical approach to make sure that you get that second area out or that the surgeon has a look at that second area and removes it.
So just to clarify for my own information, though, in terms of the clip placement, is that done at the time of the initial biopsy or after as a second procedure once it's known to be positive?
It's done at the time of the original biopsy. So typically when the radiologist does the procedure, they place a clip at the time of the biopsy.
And any impressions in terms of how common or does it ever happen that people don't put clips in?
Yes, it certainly does happen that people don't put clips in, and that complicates management considerably because, you know, the good news is that not insignificantly, particularly in the HER2-positive space, but, you know, women often get a path CR. And then you're not sure. You really want to examine the area where the cancer was. You really want to make sure that the pathologist has looked at that carefully to evaluate whether there's any residual disease. And you want to make sure that you haven't missed anything. So I think as more and more people are doing neoadjuvant chemotherapy, I think previously that used to be more the domain of clinical trials and, you know, very large primaries. I think people are increasingly remembering to make sure that clips are placed, but it is not insignificantly that you see that women don't have clips placed.
And if you see a patient that you want to give neoadjuvant therapy to and they don't have a clip, do you send them for a clip before they start?
Yes. I would definitely send them to have a clip placed. So it's another procedure for them.
But again, you know, in a patient who has, say, a, you know, 2.5 centimeter mass, which could be benign, so you're saying it should be standard that that patient like that has a clip put in?
Well, you know, if you really think that that is benign and it really has benign characteristics, I'm not sure that the radiologist places a clip all the time, but most of the times the radiologists have a good idea if this is something that looks malignant or not. And particularly if you're talking about a tumor that's at least 2 centimeters in size where you'd be considering neoadjuvant systemic therapy. So if that is the case, it is standard for most radiologists now to place a clip. I can't tell you specifically if it looks like a fibroadenoma and they're pretty sure it's a fibroadenoma, would they put in a clip? I don't think so. But if it's concerning for malignancy, then they should put in a clip.
Getting back to this case scenario, the patient with a 3.4 centimeter and a palpable axillary node, what about the choice of therapy?
So I think the big question from a systemic treatment point of view, obviously this woman has a triple negative breast cancer, so you're going to be recommending chemotherapy. The real question, the real debate in 2014 is should we be adding a platinum or not in addition to standard chemotherapy? So unless there's a contraindication to anthracyclines in a woman like this, you'd probably be recommending an anthracycline-based chemotherapy. So the big debate is do you add a platinum or not? And really that debate has been strengthened or spurned by a few recent trials in the neoadjuvant setting looking at the role of adding platinum to standard chemotherapy. So there are really two major trials that have looked at that recently where we've seen their results. The first one that we saw was a GEPR-6DO trial by the German group, and that was just published in Lancet Oncology this year in 2014. And in that trial, it was a trial that included HER2-positive and HER2-negative disease, but if we just focus on the group of women who had triple-negative breast cancer in that trial, it was a randomized trial of anthracycline-based chemotherapy, anthracycline and taxane-based chemotherapy alone, or with carboplatin. That trial used a slightly unusual chemotherapy backbone. They used a liposomal doxorubicin-paclitaxel backbone for that trial. But the concept was basically the same, an anthracycline taxane alone or anthracycline taxane plus carbo. And when they looked at the path CR rate in that trial, there was about a 14 to 15% increase in path CR rate for the women who had the carboplatin in addition to the anthracycline taxane chemotherapy. And that was statistically significant. There was a second trial that was presented, and that was the trial that was presented by Bill Sykov, the CLGB trial, that was focused solely on triple-negative breast cancer. Around 440 patients or so were randomized on that study. In that trial, the women got weekly paclitaxel for 12 weeks, followed by dose-dense AC for 4 cycles. And that was just the standard backbone. It was actually a trial that also looked at the role of bevacizumab, but I won't really focus on that part of things. But women were randomized to just get the taxane anthracycline or the taxane anthracycline during the taxane part, during the weekly paclitaxel. They also got carboplatin at an AUC of 6 given IV every 3 weeks for a total of 4 times. And again, if you looked at the past CR rate in that study, there was about a 12 to 14% absolute benefit in past CR rate in the women who got the carbo in addition to the anthracycline and paclitaxel, and that was statistically significant. The other thing that that trial found was that the women who got the platinum in addition to the standard chemotherapy, they were more likely to undergo breast conservation, and they were more likely to be converted from ineligible for breast conservation to eligible for breast conserving surgery.
And can you talk a little bit about how you make the decision clinically and the kind of patient where you might use a platinum and one where you wouldn't?
So I think part of the debate is, what does past CR mean? Is that a valid surrogate endpoint for long-term outcome? And there was a recent publication, there was an FDA sort of pooled analysis of all neoadjuvant trials that in the triple negative group indicated that women who had a past CR rate had a better outcome. It was statistically improved overall survival and event-free survival in those achieving past CR. That being said, I don't think it's been clearly shown in a single trial that that really correlates with long-term outcomes. So the reason everyone isn't jumping on this bandwagon is that not everyone agrees, and I think that's appropriate, whether past CR rate is truly a good surrogate endpoint. So I think you'll find a division in the medical oncology community about whether we should be thinking about using platinums in all triple negatives, in some triple negatives, or in no patients with triple negative breast cancer right now. And in my practice, I tend to think about it more strongly if I have somebody who is a known mutation carrier. In that group, there's stronger data supporting the role of platinums, or if somebody has a larger tumor or, you know, a significantly involved axilla, I certainly will talk to her about it. I'll talk to her about the pluses and minuses of it, and I'll more strongly consider adding a platinum. But I'll tell you, that's not universally accepted. There are, you know, well-respected breast medical oncologists who say it's not ready for prime time and we shouldn't be doing it.
You mentioned the issue of the axilla, and there's actually a couple of trials out there. NSABP and the Alliance have trials that I'm still trying to figure out. But can you talk about the issue of the axilla and these trials?
Yeah. So I think that, at least in my recent experiences, is one of the bigger issues that comes up and that we discuss in great detail at our tumor board, and I think in talking with some of my colleagues and friends, both at other academic centers and in the community, it's one of the issues that we're all scratching our heads about. So what do you do in somebody who, for instance, has a clinically positive node? You've done an FNA, you've shown that she has nodal involvement, you give them neoadjuvant chemotherapy, and either scenario, there are big questions out there, and these trials are really addressing or trying to help us answer the question. So if you have somebody who had a clinically involved node, and you give them neoadjuvant chemotherapy, and their sentinel node is now negative, what do you need to do? Beforehand, if you treated them upfront, and you'd taken that patient to surgery upfront, and you'd found that she had a T2N1 tumor, if she'd had mastectomy, she would have gotten regional nodal irradiation, okay, and chest wall post-mastectomy radiation. And she probably would have gotten regional nodal irradiation if she'd had breast conservation. But now that you have proof that you've rendered her node negative, you've shown that she has disease that responded to systemic therapy, does she still need that regional nodal irradiation? And we don't know the answer, is the bottom line. And that's why there's a randomized trial that is addressing that. And so that's really the NSABP, or what has now become NRG group. It's looking at women who had a proven positive axillary node prior to neoadjuvant chemotherapy. At the time that they get to surgery, the sentinel node is negative, and they are basically randomized to get regional nodal radiation or not, okay? Those patients don't have to get an axillary node dissection. They could have gotten it or not. They could just have a sentinel node biopsy, and they could be sentinel node negative. And I think the real kicker for a lot of people is, let's say that woman decides to have a mastectomy, and she has a past CR or just pathologically negative nodes, theoretically that woman could be randomized to get no radiation whatsoever. I think it's a question that we don't have an answer to yet, and I think that trial is an important trial that will really help us address that issue.
What do you do in your own practice in that situation?
I think it's very individualized. Ideally, honestly, I think this is one of those trials where, if possible, we should try and put as many patients as we can on that trial, because honestly, we do not know the answer to this question. We know, for most of our trials, right, we know that our therapy benefits some. And maybe this is our biological cue that this is not somebody who needed post-mastectomy radiation. And so I think it's a very valid question to ask and for us to enroll these patients on clinical trial. Now, the practicality is obviously that not everyone will have the trial open, not everyone will want to go on the trial, all of these things. you know, the standard of care would probably still be to treat them as you would treat them if they hadn't gotten the neoadjuvant therapy, but you may want to individualize it. If you have a patient who had hormone receptor positive disease or who had HER2 positive disease where you have very effective targeted therapies, maybe you'd feel more comfortable not radiating them. But I think it's a very individualized decision and honestly one for which there is no right answer, which is one of the reasons why I think this series of trials is such an important series of trials.
What's the other study, the Alliance study, looking at?
Yeah, so the Alliance trial is for the flip, okay? It's for you had somebody with a clinically positive node, you give them neoadjuvant chemotherapy, and they still have nodal involvement. And so then you're basically asking the question, do they need an axillary node dissection too? Or could you just radiate their axilla? But they can't have gross disease, okay? So they have to not have a clinically involved axilla at the end of their neoadjuvant chemotherapy. And so it's basically the AMOROS trial, if you'll recall, the AMOROS trial, that was the European trial that randomized women who at surgery, not the neoadjuvant setting, but that was a trial that randomized women who had a sentinel node positive disease and randomized them to axillary node dissection versus axillary radiation, and showed that their long-term outcome was identical and that they had less lymphedema when they got axillary radiation, but they had a little bit more arm stiffness. So showed that you could do that. So what the Alliance trial is sort of the AMOROS trial in the neoadjuvant setting. And what it's asking is, sort of distilling it, it's asking the optimal management of the axilla in the face of a positive sentinel node. Do they need an axillary node dissection, or could they just have axillary radiation instead? All of the patients in this trial get breast or chest wall radiation, and they all get regional nodal irradiation. The only question in this trial is, what do you do with the axilla? Do you do an axillary node dissection? And if you do the axillary node dissection, they don't get axillary radiation. Or do you just do axillary RT and not take them back for an axillary node dissection?
So in terms of the neoadjuvant treatment, do you generally deliver all the therapy that you want to give up front, or are there situations where you split it and do some after surgery?
So typically I give it all up front if I can. So if I'm planning, for instance, to give dose-dense chemotherapy, I would give it all up front and not interrupt it typically.
What about in the HER2-positive situation in terms of, again, the chemo, all up front or split?
So it depends. And right now, I think we're just in a slightly funny place because of where we are with this accelerated approval of pertuzumab. I think it depends on the chemotherapy regimen you're going to give. So if I gave docetaxel, carboplatin, trastuzumab, and pertuzumab, I would give it all up front. So I'd give what I call TCHP for 6 cycles up front and then have them go to surgery and then finish off a year of trastuzumab. The other way to give it is to give a taxane with the trastuzumab and pertuzumab preoperatively, and then you could give, if you like, doxorubicin, you can give your AC after. You could also do a regimen that we don't use that often in this country, but that's the FEC regimen, the 5-fluorouracil epirubicin and cyclophosphamide, and then give the taxane with pertuzumab and trastuzumab for 3 cycles. So there are lots of different ways to do it. I'd say in the States, the most common way that it's done is TCHP for 6 cycles. Preoperatively, take them to surgery and finish off the trastuzumab for a year. Or give them, you know, for instance, weekly paclitaxel with trastuzumab and pertuzumab for 12 weeks, then take them to surgery and give your AC after. And then once you're done with your AC, obviously finish off your year of trastuzumab.
So just to finish out with this triple negative case, how would you approach this patient if she had post-op disease, residual disease?
These are all really difficult questions that we don't have good answers to, which is obviously why we're talking about them. So if she has residual disease, one of the questions that came up, if you didn't give her a platinum up front, would you think about giving it to her post-operatively? There is a study that is planning to look at this. ECOG has a trial planned where they're planning to look at 4 cycles of post-surgical platinum single agent given for women who have significant residual disease following standard neoadjuvant chemotherapy. Outside of the setting of a trial, I think it's an individualized decision, a discussion of pluses and minuses, and where we are in the absence of a lot of information. You know, if you found out in the interim for instance, that your patient had genetic testing, was found to carry a BRCA1 or BRCA2 mutation, I'd say outside of the setting of a trial, I would consider it, and I would consider it more strongly in a patient like that. And if a patient has significant residual disease, I think it's a discussion to be had. I think obviously we won't know the answer until we get the clinical trial. We don't know whether more chemotherapy makes a difference there.
So in other parts of this program, we go through the whole neoadjuvant story with HER2 positive disease. But one thing I did want to ask you about, which I don't think we have covered that well, is that same question about post-op residual disease. Are you a member of the NSABP?
We're a member of Alliance.
Alliance, okay. Because I was curious in terms of your approach to the patient with HER2 positive disease and residual disease, and what the trial options are that you consider. I think the NSABP Catherine study with the T-DM1 is very interesting.
Yeah, that is a very interesting trial, and I think one that, again, will be very important. I tend to view residual disease post-neoadjuvant chemotherapy very differently in patients who have ER or hormone receptor positive breast cancer as opposed to hormone receptor negative. So I think that's a really important thing to remember. And I also think it's an important thing to tell your patients. You know, if they have a hormone receptor positive disease, they need to know that it's not as clinically significant, whether they have a past CR or not, and it's much less common, and it does not seem to have the same prognostic value. So if a patient had hormone receptor positive disease, I would feel less concerned than if they had hormone receptor negative disease and had a lot of residual disease. I think the Catherine trial is a really interesting trial. The Catherine trial is asking in a patient who has residual disease, looking at the role of T-DM1, a more novel HER2-targeted therapy, and asking the question about whether that would be better than finishing off the year with trastuzumab. And so in a patient with HER2-positive disease or significant residual disease with HER2-positive disease, I think that's a very worthwhile trial to try and find for your patient. And certainly if I have a patient like that, I'll look around for a site who has it open.
The situation of the ER-positive HER2-negative disease also brings up the question of using a genomic biomarker test in the neoadjuvant setting, for example, Oncotype. Do you see any role for that?
Yeah, that's being evaluated in some trials as well, and I do see a role for that. Actually, I just saw a patient not too long ago that we were considering for participation in the I-SPY 2 trial and had a lot of discussion back and forth, and she was considering neoadjuvant endocrine therapy alone. And it was unclear. She's a lady who had lost insurance, had not had imaging for a while, but we ended up after a lot of discussion, because she was very interested in endocrine therapy alone, we discussed doing the Oncotype and seeing whether that would help guide us. And if she'd had a really low Oncotype, maybe we would have felt more comfortable. Obviously, I think in a somewhat older patient, which this lady wasn't, she was in her early 50s, neoadjuvant endocrine therapy is an appropriate approach, period.
This kind of leads into your 40-year-old lady, that scenario. Maybe you can talk about that with the 2 centimeter tumor.
Yeah. So another area that's very controversial right now in the adjuvant setting is really what's the optimal endocrine therapy for a premenopausal woman. So I think we all have a number of these patients in our practice, you know, a young patient who someone, you know, the scenario that I thought of was, let's say you have a 38-year-old woman who has a hormone receptor positive breast cancer, and the question about what is the optimal endocrine therapy for that woman. And at ASCO this year, there was a plenary presentation with the sort of joint analysis of the SOFT and TEXT trials, the two large international trials looking at optimizing endocrine therapy in premenopausal women. So the SOFT trial is the one that I think will be most informative for us in this country, and we don't have the full results right now, but we will by San Antonio, where it's supposed to be presented. The SOFT trial was a 3-arm randomization for premenopausal women with hormone receptor positive disease. They could have gotten chemotherapy or not. If they did get chemotherapy, they had to maintain menstrual function. And basically the randomization was to tamoxifen alone, ovarian functional suppression plus tamoxifen, ovarian functional suppression plus exemestane. And the TEXT trial was just a 2-arm randomization. All these premenopausal women got ovarian functional suppression, and they either got it with TAM or with exemestane. So there was a joint analysis putting together the 2 ovarian functional suppression arms of those 2 trials. And what was found was that there was a benefit, or that the women who got ovarian functional suppression plus the AI, in this case exemestane, had an improvement in disease-free survival. The improvement overall was about a 3.5 to 4% absolute improvement in disease-free survival, which was statistically significant. That, of course, included local regional recurrences, contralateral breast cancers. But if you looked at distant disease-free survival, there was about a 2% improvement in the ovarian functional suppression plus the XMS stain versus ovarian functional suppression plus TAM. And there was absolutely no difference in overall survival. I think many of us, or at least what I am doing, is if I see a patient today and making decisions about endocrine therapy in her, I personally would like to see what the TAM alone arm looks like. You know, if you asked me to bet, what do I believe? I do not believe that tamoxifen alone is better than ovarian functional suppression plus tamoxifen. Okay, the question is, how does TAM alone compare to ovarian functional suppression with either TAM or ovarian functional suppression plus exemestin? Because clearly we give these women a lot more toxicity when we suppress their ovarian function. And what's really important for us to know is, what is the magnitude of benefit? So I personally am waiting till San Antonio before I change things. Obviously, I have individual discussions with my patients. And in a really high-risk patient, you might choose to do ovarian functional suppression at the get-go. But I've been holding off and waiting for San Antonio so I can really do that delicate risk-benefit balance that we spend all of our time doing with our patients.
What about the issue of oncotype in this case scenario of the patient with a 2-centimeter lesion, negative sentinel nodes after having had a lumpectomy? You put down here a recurrence score 12. How do you currently utilize the recurrence score, and how would you manage this patient, and what would you do if the score were intermediate?
Yeah, so, you know, this scenario is of a 40-year-old woman with a 2-centimeter hormone receptor positive HER2-negative breast cancer who has a recurrence score of 12. And a patient like that, that is a low recurrence score, and I personally feel very comfortable recommending endocrine therapy alone for a patient like that. I think there's a gray zone, obviously, and where you put your boundaries will, I think, change also depending on the tumor size and the patient's age and various things. So I think what's clear is if it's a low score, particularly a lower low score, then you're going to recommend endocrine therapy alone. If the recurrence score is above the cutoff point of 31, we'll recommend chemotherapy. It's a gray zone in between. So for an intermediate score in a 40-year-old, I would have a discussion about the limitations of our knowledge. Obviously, we're all waiting on the results of the TAILOR-X trial that randomized patients with recurrent scores of 11 to 25 to chemo versus not. I tell them that we have to have equipoise, otherwise we couldn't have enrolled women on this trial. And if I have a younger woman who has a recurrent score of 24, I might think a little bit more about chemotherapy than if I have an older patient with a similar score, or if I have a recurrent score of 18, I view it differently than 28. I mean, I think this is a continuous variable. It's not categorical, and so all of those things factor in.
What about the same scenario that you described, except, let's say, you have one positive node?
So in a premenopausal woman, there are absolutely, I would remind everyone that there are absolutely no data on the use of recurrent score in premenopausal women with node-positive disease. So I personally do not use it in that patient population. The data that exist about recurrent score and its impact on decision-making are from the SWOG trial that was in postmenopausal women and suggested that for postmenopausal women with node-positive disease, obviously all of these women had hormone receptor-positive disease, they had a low recurrent score, there was no further benefit of chemotherapy, and if they had a high recurrent score, there was a significant benefit. That being said, I think it's important to remember that the risk of recurrence, even with a low recurrent score tumor, was upwards of 30%, distant recurrence was upward of 30% in those women. So again, I tend to individualize it a little bit. You know, if it's an older postmenopausal woman, I feel very comfortable. If it's a 53-year-old with 3 positive nodes, would I do it? I personally would not do it. Again, there are other colleagues of mine who I respect tremendously who use it. But from my perspective, I'm a little bit concerned. What if the definitive trials don't reproduce that? And then we're leaving that woman with a very high risk of distant recurrence.
So let's finish out talking about your 58-year-old lady with a large ER-positive HER2-negative breast cancer.
So recently I've seen a number of patients like this who have presented, and as they've gotten worked up because they have a large tumor or clinically palpable nodes on staging studies, they're found to have metastatic disease. So this particular patient on CT scan was found to have a liver lesion. I always biopsy, if at all possible, any suspected sites of metastasis, and I do it for two reasons. One, sometimes it's not a metastasis, and that's obviously critically important, so you really want to confirm it as opposed to thinking that it's Mets. And then the second thing is I always repeat ERPR and HER2 on the Met as well as on the primary just to make sure that they're concordant. A number of studies have shown us that for ER and PR, the discordance rate can be anywhere around from 15 to 20% between the primary and the Met. And for HER2, the discordance rate goes from about 5 to 15%, depending on the studies. So I like to make sure that I know what the characteristics of the Met are as well. And so then the question comes up, if you have a patient who is diagnosed with de novo metastatic disease, how do you approach their treatment? And I think there are a couple of issues in this case. This is a patient who now has biopsy-confirmed liver metastasis with a hormone receptor-positive breast cancer. Could we give her endocrine? So from a systemic treatment point of view, can we give her endocrine therapy alone? And, you know, the traditional teaching had been that if you have visceral metastasis, no, but I think that that has evolved over time. And really what we're thinking about is a significant burden of visceral metastases. So I have to say in a patient like this, assuming that she is compliant and she will follow up, I would tend to feel very comfortable giving her endocrine therapy at the get-go. She has hormone receptor positive metastatic disease in terms of a quality of life perspective. She'll get much better quality of life on endocrine therapy than chemotherapy, and she stands a good chance of having a good response to it. The other thing to think about is, you know, there are some data that have recently emerged with some of the newer targeted therapies. So with the CDK4/6 inhibitors, there was some very encouraging data from a randomized phase 2 trial that when given in addition to endocrine therapy to an aromatase inhibitor, there was a significant improvement in progression-free survival. The phase 3 trial has completed accrual and we're waiting on the results of that. So I think all of us have our ears to the ground waiting to see what the data show from these CDK4/6 inhibitors. So this particular patient, because we do have the trial open, is on that trial. But the other issue that I think a patient like this brings up is how do you manage the primary in somebody with de novo who's presenting with metastatic disease? Do you take them to surgery or not? And at San Antonio in December 2013, two randomized clinical trials were presented that looked at the role of local regional therapy in women presenting with de novo disease.
Those two trials were pretty negative, I guess.
Yeah, the two trials were pretty negative. I think there were issues with them, though. So I have to say that what they did for me is encourage me to try and put people on the existing U.S. trial, the ECOG trial that's led by Seema Khan, which is really asking that question. So the two trials, one was a trial out of India that looked at women who had response to first-line chemotherapy. They all got first-line chemotherapy, and the women who had response were randomized to local regional therapy or no local regional therapy. And there was no difference in overall survival or median overall survival. The issue with that trial is that none of the women who had HER2-positive disease got HER2-targeted therapy, and I think we know what a profound impact that has. The results were not actually even stratified by that, and it was not a huge trial. It was, you know, 350 patients or so. So I think there are questions in that trial about does that apply to our current standard. Obviously, for patients with HER2-positive disease today, we wouldn't think about not giving them HER2-targeted therapy. We know what a profound impact that has on their outcome. And then the other trial was a trial from Turkey that randomized women who were diagnosed, who at presentation had metastatic disease, randomized them to upfront local regional therapy or not. And then for the women, just in both of those trials, for the women who did not get local regional therapy in the randomization, if their physician or healthcare team felt like they needed local therapy for palliation, then obviously they can go to that therapy. And in the Turkish trial, there was about a 4-month prolongation in overall survival that was not statistically significant for the women who got local regional therapy. The suggestion was that in women who had a solitary bone met, maybe there was a benefit. I think the issue with that is that not all those women got biopsied, and maybe not all of those things were actually bone mets. Maybe they were bone islands or something benign. So I think we don't know, but what it suggests is it certainly should temper our enthusiasm for sending these women to surgery. Okay, I think there's no question that it should do that, because my sense is in this country before these trials, there was a feeling, because the retrospective data strongly suggests there was a benefit to surgery up front. There was a tendency to send these women to surgery. I think these trials did not definitively answer the question for us yet and should really, again, encourage us, if possible, to put these women on the existing trials or to keep on accruing to the existing trials in this country and others that will more definitively answer the question.